You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
As the generation that came of age around the time of the millennium establishes itself as adults, many have tried to determine the role it is likely to play in the United States and the larger world. Millennials, as they have been termed, have frequently been characterized as an extension of the me generation, entitled narcissistic and apathetic. Some have even dubbed them the dumbest generation. David Burstein, who's a millennial himself, argues that this is not so and that his generation is proving itself to be entrepreneurial and optimistic in the face of America's worst economy since the Depression. Mr. Burstein is the founder and executive director of the Youth Voter Engagement Organization, Generation 18, and director of the documentary films 18 and 08 and Up to Us. His book, Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World, is published by Beacon Press, and I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today. Hello.
Great to be with you.
I also invite listeners to participate in this, share your opinions on the millennial generation by giving us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org. You can tweet us. Our handle is at Leonard Lopate. You can also connect to us on Facebook. So, David, what's the age range of millennials today?
So this is a generation of people born who are today between about 18 and 31.
But that's a big range.
Yeah, it's actually 80 million people. This is the largest generation in history, even larger than the boomers.
Is it possible to characterize generations?
Well, you know, it's inherently a construct to try and, you know, make a claim about a group of people, especially when as large as 80 million. And I think, you know, what is important to remember is when I talk about the things that are going on in this generation, we're talking about what are the most exciting and important trends in this generation that are having an impact on all other generations.
In the United States alone, or are we seeing something similar around the world?
You know, this is actually really the first global generation that realizes its true global nature and the interconnectedness of their peers all over the world. And it's one that realizes that with one click, you can be in touch with my phone, with people all over the world. So that's a real change.
So why do you think this generation is getting such a bad rap?
I think because people don't know how to understand this generation, don't know how to process it. When you look at the way that this generation, for instance, has engaged in activism, we're not out in the streets protesting. We're using new tools, social media and technology, and we're also looking at ways of creating social change by starting businesses and organizations. To a lot of people, that looks lazy because you can't see that as concretely as you can see lots of people marching on the mall.
This is the first generation to be born into a time of technology or the new technologies?
Yeah, but it's important to remember that this generation actually straddles the line between the pre-digital and the digital, because this generation was born without smartphones. We didn't have Facebook when we were in middle school. We didn't get it maybe until we were in college. And that actually is an important difference. We did our first research projects in libraries. You know, we had this sort of grounding in a world before sort of mass technology that could answer every question.
So why has this generation stopped going to libraries altogether? I heard a report this morning on NPR about the sale of the Boston Globe, and they asked students in Boston and the area around Boston, a great university area, are you going to miss the Globe? And most of them said, well, I don't really read newspapers, but the only time I ever read the Globe is when a teacher signs.
Well, you know, actually, this generation does have a deep appreciation for good content and for news content. And I think the platforms are just changing. People are going to libraries, although increasingly people are going to libraries to use the internet, because that's become one of the main reasons that people go there. I think that there's actually a sense with printed material, you're finding more and more millennials are actually wanting to touch that and to have that experience. But I think really what matters is the content, and people do miss good quality content, which is why this generation is actually risen their viewership on shows, you know, that have that kind of content.
What does your title Fast Future refer to?
So the Fast Future is sort of the world that we're living in right now. If you think about the change that has taken place in the past 5 years as this generation has been coming of age, we're not really able to look more than a few years into the future and sort of think about gee, what could happen 5 years from now? We're living in this world where the present, the line between the present and the future, is constantly becoming blurred. And it's a real advantage for this generation as other generations are trying to figure out how to adapt to that.
As a follow-up, I'm going to take a call. Our caller, Aster from Piscataway. Aster, you're on the air.
Thank you. I love your show. Yeah, I have a question. I know you opened the show by defining what you're calling millennials, but I am really confused as to what is a Gen Xer, what is a Gen Y. I think I have the baby boomer thing down. And what, like, how do you define millennials? And what are we calling the generation that's coming after if this current generation of adults are the millennials?
And if they're Generation Z, what happens after that? Do we go to AA and BB?
that's a good question that we're going to have to figure out. But yeah, so the generation after is Generation Z, and you know, there are a number of different statistics and ways people define this generation. In general, the most important quality is that this is a generation who in some way came of age around the time of the millennium. So they were either, you know, I put in the book that one of the most important things is that this is a generation of people to be a millennial. You have to have some important ability to remember 9/11 and sort of these transformative, if you were sort of five or four at that time, you didn't really have that kind of impact. Similarly, if you were in your, you know, late 20s, you weren't really able to sort of take that and put that into your forming consciousness.
And why 9/11 in particular? Because that is a turning point in your
life? That was really a turning point. And for this generation, it was a moment at which this generation helped form their civic mindedness and their orientation around trying to solve the world's problems and have social impact.
People we're calling digital natives, aren't they, as opposed to digital immigrants?
Yeah, because – and it's an interesting metaphor because this is not to say that people of other generations aren't able to use the internet and figure out how to master technology. That's not what we're talking about. But this generation, everything about technology, every new platform comes to us intuitively. We've been the early adopters of Facebook, of Twitter, and in many cases, we've been the people who created these platforms altogether. So we have a kind of fluency of being able to operate in this landscape.
Is it breaking down class divides and social divides and racial divides?
It absolutely is, because actually what's interesting is that smartphone penetration among minority youth is actually higher than it is for white youth. And it's allowing, you know, underserved communities to have access to all sorts of information and to, in many cases, have the ability to get out of, you know, the place that they're in. I'll give you just one example. In my book, I talk about a guy who, you know, uses the internet to find out that he could make T-shirts and sell T-shirts. He's a kid from Brooklyn who really had no opportunity before this, and now he's able to sell T-shirts and figure out how to make them through technology.
But most of the people you're writing about in this book are from the middle and upper middle class, the people who have the resources, time, and parental support to do the things that you're writing about.
That's not entirely true. There's a lot, you know, there's some exciting things that are being done by people in that class, but there's also people all over this country who are having an unprecedented level of access to information and an ability to scale what they're doing. If you talk about the ease with which someone can turn from an ordinary person into an activist by sharing a message with the world, it's really something that has taken on a new life in this generation.
Now, what does activist mean in this case? I don't see a lot of young people going to Washington and marching with signs.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that's this generation is remaking the face of activism. And, you know, I'll give you another great example from the book, which is that there's two guys in Wilmington, Ohio, who saw what the unemployment crisis was doing in their hometown. It was 19% at one point in Wilmington. And they decided to start an organization to try and transform the residents of their community into agents of economic change. And they created a fellows program to bring young people back to Wilmington to help train businesses in new skills. They got the region certified as a green enterprise zone. They started a campaign to get people to buy local products. So there's really a lot of things like that, people creating organizations, working outside the system, on the fringes, or creating their own institutions. That's really what activism is looking like.
Outside the system because they have grown up in a time of political gridlock and see the political process as being kind of useless for them?
Yeah, and they see, I think like most Americans, they have deep frustration with the political process. But importantly, that doesn't translate into this generation not voting. In 2012 and 2008, we saw tremendous levels of youth voting, some of the highest on record. And people thought that in 2012, young people were going to be a disappointment and not turn out. And in fact, we actually saw that youth voter turnout was just about as high as it was in 2008.
Still, some have criticized millennials for confusing awareness with activism. That they feel as though posting a comment or joining a group is sufficient. Well, but people in the past might say, well, that isn't – that's nice, but that's not sufficient.
I think it's important to keep in mind that millennials don't view posting a comment as some great contribution to changing the world, but they are doing it now. And everything we know about how we develop and how we form our habits and how we form our lifelong behaviors suggests that – you know, if we give $5 when we're younger, we're going to become more philanthropic later in life. When we engage in a beginning form of activism when we're younger, that's going to continue to grow as we go on.
Some have observed that bright college graduates are increasingly looking to make money instead of going into government. That's partly because, I guess, college debt forces many recent graduates to prioritize finding high jobs. In the past, a lot of people had felt they had the luxury of being able to sort things out for a while.
Well, I think you're seeing, like in any generation, a mix of people who want to make money and people who, you know, there are people who are moving back home with their parents and spending time, you know, trying to get to that next step. There's been the rise of a concept that is now being referred to as emerging adulthood, this idea that people are spending more time before they sort of launch out into the world thinking about what is it I want to do. And we're actually seeing, in terms of people who are going into big corporate jobs, you know, for the first time in decades, the freshman research survey out of UCLA shows that business is no longer the most popular major of college students, which it had been for a long time. So
what
people are
now
rethinking that.
They're not becoming English majors.
No, I think it's political science has now taken that place.
You suggest that millennials blend pragmatism and idealism. In what ways?
Yeah, so when you think about looking at the world we're living in and how best to make change, people in this generation realize that businesses are big and they're a force in our world, that our political system, however frustrating it might be, is a reality of living in this time. So we say, how, if we want to do something about climate change, how can we best do that? And so you've seen a lot of young people going to start green energy companies, startup companies, as opposed to going down and marching. But yet we also see some in the street activism. We've seen ways of sort of working with businesses, of working with institutions. We understand that if you want to achieve that kind of change, you have to have a plan in order to get there.
Well, what's yours? You created Generation 18, didn't you?
Yeah. And part of the goal of what we did was not just to register young voters, but we took a film out all over the country, both in 2008 and 2012, and used it as a way to not just register voters, but to give young people a tool to go out and engage their peers.
This was aimed at people who reached the voting age in time for the 2008 election.
Right. And we did it again in 2012 as well.
And did you find that most of them were were they split party-wise?
This generation tends to vote more Democratic than Republican.
We're not seeing a lot of Tea Party millennials?
No, there's not much support for the Tea Party among young people. But I also think that, what's interesting is this is not a generation that identifies as members of parties. Even though their votes have tended to be more Democratic than Republican, they are not just down the ballot voters for Democrats, whatever goes. Both parties are going to have to work to earn the votes of this generation.
Although most of the pundits are saying that the Republicans are going to be hurt a lot by some of their positions because younger people are much more likely to support same-sex marriage, abortion rights, and a whole bunch of other things that the Republican Party has been opposed to for years.
Yeah, and it's actually something we're
immigration reform.
We're now even seeing young Republicans talking about that, who are lifelong young Republicans, saying that their government needs to do that. A number of college Republican organizations, including here in New York at Columbia, started coming out in favor of endorsing same-sex marriage and things like that. So we're seeing a movement even among young Republicans to adopt some of those social views.
My guest is David Burstein. His book, Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. It's published by Beacon Press. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with David D. Burstein, founder and executive director of the youth voter engagement organization called Generation 18, director of the documentary films 18 and 08 and Up to Us. He has written a book called Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. It's published by Beacon Press. And people have been calling in and writing. I'm going to first read something from Eric from Brooklyn. He says, it's more likely that those of this generation who shape the world will be from China and India. They have more for which to strive, more to benefit, and have more practical education and skills than the spoiled offspring of Western baby boomers.
You know, it's interesting because there are a lot of people in China and India, young people who are espousing some of these similar ideas, and you're seeing, you know, young people who are having these ideas of idealism and caring about environmental issues and social justice coming out of those backgrounds. I would take issue with the idea that it's not going to be, you know, first of all, that they're spoiled children of Western baby boomers. I also think that there is more awareness and connection of what people are doing in China and India on the part of people in America than there really ever has been before as global peers.
In fact, somebody from Africa once said to me that she felt that people all over the world should be allowed to vote in U.S. elections because the president of the United States affects everybody's life.
It's true. And I think that, you know, this generation has taken ownership of that idea and wants to have a good legacy and leave the world better than we found it.
Ian from New Brunswick, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah, I kind of wanted to commiserate with David Burstein, the author. You know, I've read, I am a millennial, and I've read Thomas Wolfe's article about the 1970s. He called that the Me Decade.
Yeah.
Douglas Copeland's novel, Generation X, called people coming of age in the 90s the Me Generation, and now we're getting the same thing here in the 2000s and beyond. I was wondering if you think that really any generalizations can be that true, especially when we hear the same generalizations between generation to generation.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up because it's fascinating the history with which this goes through. Every generation, as young people, is viewed similarly as not doing enough. They don't know how the world works. They're entitled. They're selfish. And then, as time goes on, we start to reflect on them as you know. And that's happened. People forget that the greatest generation, who we now call the greatest generation, during the 1960s, were roundly criticized for not, you know, participating in the civil rights movement and sort of standing on the sidelines during a lot of that.
On the other hand, young people did get very much involved in the criticism of the Vietnam War. Was that because they were more committed or simply because there was a draft at that time?
I think it's definitely both. I think that there was an important piece of having a deep personal connection to both the Vietnam War and with the civil rights movement, seeing very visceral images that really, you know, we don't have in this generation. And that's why I actually think the activism on the part of the millennials is much more sustainable because it doesn't arise out of, you know, some deep personal connection like the draft did. And it isn't connected to sort of seeing these, you know, this one kind of incident. Because if you look at what happened after the civil rights movement and the Vietnam War were ended, a lot of boomer activism, you know, dissipated after that. And I don't think that's going to happen with this generation.
Well, this generation has been accused of being apathetic in the face of what many see as unjust wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, extrajudicial killings like drone strikes. Why isn't there more outrage?
Well, it's important to remember that this is a generation that overwhelmingly fought in these wars. I mean, this is a generation where the overwhelming majority of the military is comprised of millennials. But there's a real divide between the millennials in this generation who are fighting the wars and the others who are able to sort of go on with their lives because we've lived under the specter of two wars without really having to ask anyone to sacrifice or to make sacrifices or acknowledge that that's what's going on in our world.
You mentioned earlier that the millennials also are characterized by having experienced the aftermath of 9/11. Is that very different from a previous generation living through the assassinations of John F. Kennedy and then Bobby Kennedy and Malcolm X and Martin Luther King?
I think it is different for a couple reasons. One is that the experience of watching sort of the Kennedy assassination and those things was much more unified. People had a much more unified response, and it was a much more definitive act. If you go back to thinking about 9/11, there were a series of things that happened. First, there was the first plane, then there was the second plane, then there was, you know, quickly we learned who the perpetrators were, then we went into thinking about the war in Afghanistan. So it wasn't sort of this one defining moment. It was, for a lot of people, it was about becoming more political. For a lot of people, it was about becoming more civic-minded. For a lot of people, it was about going into the military. So there were really a lot of different responses, but what we saw immediately afterwards was a rise in volunteerism, particularly in this generation that's really stuck with this generation throughout, this sense of seeing problems and wanting to do something about them.
A lot of people who did join the military joined as a direct result of the 9/11 attacks.
Yeah, and that the numbers for military enrollment went up, as did numbers for Teach for America and the Peace Corps in the direct aftermath, and those have continued to go up.
Trish from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you all? David, I just wanted to really thank you for your points and chime in. I run an organization called the Young Nonprofit Professionals Network, and we have about 40,000 members across the country, people in their 20s and 30s who work for the nonprofit sector. And just wanted to echo the point you're making earlier about sort of the variety of ways that people see themselves making change nowadays, especially with this younger generation. We were founded by Gen Xers basically 15 years ago, who saw the nonprofit sector as really the only place where they could make change, really work for a purpose. And as the millennials have really entered the workforce, we've really just seen a shift in, we've seen an increase in our membership, but definitely a shift in terms of you know, the commitment of our members to the nonprofit sector is the only place that they can make change. You know, it used to be when we would survey our members, 75% of them would say that they saw themselves in the nonprofit sector for the rest of their lives. And now we see just much more sector agnosticism. So, you know, lots of people, everyone's still very committed to working for mission-driven organizations. But, you know, definitely numbers closer to 40% of our members who say that, you know, they want to stay in the nonprofit sector for the rest of their lives or see that as the only place to make change. So just wanted to echo that point and also say that I think it's really exciting, the fact that this generation really sees the intersections between the ways that different entities, government, business, can be a part of building a better world. So definitely something we can look to the younger generation around that.
In contrast, a listener, Mike from New Jersey, called in to ask about how the huge amount of debt millennials will be facing will affect their activism.
You know, it's interesting. While we've been on the air, a report came out from the Pew Center, which actually found that the sort of enormous debt that young people had in 2008 has now been slightly reduced. And that so we're actually starting to see already, you know, some of that debt being shed. However, I don't want to paint a totally rosy picture. But what's important to remember is this generation views their sense of optimism and their resilience, their ability to get out of that ultimately, as not something that's going to totally weigh them down and sort of you know, make them unable to move forward on a day-by-day basis.
Luna in Little Neck left this comment on our show page. As a millennial myself, I'm 31, I think that our generation gets a bad rap for feeling entitled because we're waiting later to have children and start families. I don't have kids, and I just got married last year, so I've had lots of time to devote to myself. This was a personal decision for me. I think it's very different from my parents, who were both baby boomers.
We're seeing that the rates of home ownership, marriage, and car ownership are the lowest they have ever been for a youth demographic right now.
Well, is that because of decisions being made or just because money, there isn't as much money?
It's a combination of the two. I think the economy is forcing those decisions, but also, you know, I was recently at a college campus in Virginia and I asked everyone to raise their hand if they felt like getting married was something that was really important to them. Maybe, you know, a smattering of hands went up. But then when I asked them, is finding someone you love and care about something that matters to you? everyone raised their hand. So I think there's a shift in the values of the American dream, moving away from, you know, I have to own a home, and thinking more about what am I part of a good community, and less away from, more away from marriage, and more towards finding love and partners and companionship.
Andrew from Stanford, hi, you're on the air.
Hi there. I absolutely love your show. perfect, listen to it every day. Anyway, I'm a millennial, I'm 25, and the best thing I see in my generation is that it's all about bridging gaps. We bridge the gap between the Cold War and modern warfare. We bridge the gap between analog and digital. We're helping to bridge the gap between private industry and not-for-profit, as you've mentioned, and I think that mentality is going to help us lead to a lot of innovations and a lot of changes in the coming world.
I agree, and I think, you know, going back to what the earlier caller said about the nonprofit sector as well, and in the business sector, for the first time, we see the possibility that we could start a business, that we could start an organization. You know, 10 years ago, you had to go work for something else. Now that process has been demystified and the power has been pushed down, where as an individual, you feel empowered to do that.
Lena Dunham has received a lot of attention for her representation of the millennial generation in her HBO series, Girls. Have you watched the show?
I have watched the show.
Do you think that it's an accurate representation of the generation?
I don't think, first of all, I think, you know, it's an incredibly well-written show, and Lena deserves a lot of praise for being able to put it together, and I think, you know, is an example of the kind of things that millennials can do as a you know, 20-something show creator being able to write that show and put it together. But I think that it's not representative of everything in this generation. It's certainly representative of one strand of people who have different attitudes about relationships and sex, and I think that's something that's certainly changing.
Well, she's received criticism for a lack of ethnic and socioeconomic diversity on the show. Is it difficult to give a single characterization of a generation across class and racial lines?
I don't think it's that difficult to give that representation.
Well, do you think that a young African-American kid or a young Mexican-American kid is going to hear the same things from this conversation than a kid who grew up in the Upper West Side of Manhattan?
Look, I think that
a white kid who grew up.
I think that the views and the experiences of this generation, perhaps more so than ever, are similar across, you know, across class and ethnic lines. That doesn't mean that there aren't people with those unique experiences.
Well, what effect has the growing income disparity of the United States had?
Well, young people are, you know, earning less, but they're also having to, as we talked about before, pay for less. The idea is based that these people are going to own homes, and they're going to buy cars, and they're going to get married. So when people aren't doing that, it changes the dynamics of how people are doing their long-term financial thinking. And people are also, in this generation, learning how to do more with less. They're learning, because of the economic crisis, we're not waiting for government to sort of hand us a check to figure out how to live our lives. We're actually making decisions and being frugal and figuring out how to make the best with what we have.
At a time when areas that young people who were trying to save money, those areas are being changed. Williamsburg, for example, which used to be inexpensive, now has become very expensive.
Yeah.
But there's still a lot of millennials there, I guess. They're the ones on trust funds.
Well, sure. I mean, again, I think it's important to acknowledge that one other note here, which is that it's never been more possible for the opinions and the thoughts and the experiences of people in that, you know, upper, you know, more elite group to travel down across sectors because of social media, because of technology. You know, it's not possible anymore to live under a rock. If I'm friends with you and you have a different life experience than me, you can't avoid hearing about what I have to say because I'm telling you it. I'm sharing that with you. I'm broadcasting it.
Well, getting back to the idea of the me generation, do you think that media like Facebook is part of the reason millennials are seen as narcissistic?
One perception by older generations is that social media is about me and about saying what's going on with me.
Well, but isn't it?
Well, for people in this generation, it's about sharing. It's about sharing and connecting, and it's about, you know, the idea that I want my friends to know what's going on with me. I want to be able to share with them. So you see a difference in the language that millennials use, which is about sharing, and the language that older people use, which is about, you know, saying what's going on with me and my life is important. It's about I want other people to know what's going on so we can have a conversation.
What about the concept of having a personal brand? Isn't that new?
That's definitely new, and it's something that a lot of that, again, has come out of the recession, this idea that people have to be able to do multiple things. They may not, you know, go work for a company because there aren't all those jobs, so they have to sell themselves, as whether they're a web designer, whether they're a freelancer, whether they're, you know, trying to make their name as a chef or starting a cooking blog. So that's become much more important, and millennials are getting comfortable with that. But that's a reality of the economy. It shouldn't be perceived as they are so full of themselves that they want to tell everyone who they are and promote their brand.
But some people are concerned that millennials seem less concerned with their privacy than previous generations. And a number of people are saying, well, okay, so now you can post nude pictures of yourself on the internet. This is going to come back to haunt you somewhere in the future.
I think that when we look at electing the first millennial president, you know, 20 years from now.
They'll say he inhaled.
And everybody will understand. You know, those right now, those pictures, you know, Jon Favreau, the now former director of the White House speechwriting office, got into some hot water because there was a picture of him with Hillary that sort of, or a Hillary stand-in that appeared on Facebook, and it was scandalous. But when people of this generation make up the majority of the voting population, those views, those feelings about, oh, controversial Facebook pictures are going to become more normalized.
A listener writes in, Matt from Sunnyside, I absolutely disagree with David Burstein's claim that technology has been the great democratizer across class and race lines for the millennials. I'm a 35-year-old teacher at a local college whose population is largely minority and lower middle class, working class, or poor. In my experience, a large portion of my students are not at all savvy with all the technology that has been made available to them. Often, for example, I find myself teaching young students something as simple as how to double space a document, how to send an email to more than one recipient, how to do a simple internet search, or how to read a Wikipedia entry.
We do need to do more on these fundamental skills, and I would not say that technology is a panacea to cure all the problems in our world, but what we're seeing, the ability for people to have access to information, I would note on email, millennials are taking, are declining email in favor of texting, and that's particularly something that's true among minority populations. So the concerns about sending emails, we may not be sending as many emails 10 years from now. We may be sending more text messages, for instance. But I think we need to do more to teach people how do you do an internet search, because even people in, you know, white suburban areas don't know, you know, that is not something that's being taught. That's not something that is being taught. These are the new skills of our new world.
If you had to name a couple of millennials who you think exemplify the trends that you see, who would you name?
I think that, you know, Mark Zuckerberg is a great example, and I talk about him.
Is he a good role model?
I don't know if I would necessarily describe it as a role model so much as an example of the entrepreneurial spirit in this generation and the ability to, you know, Facebook is in a lot of ways a millennial company. It's started by millennials. It's run by millennials. And it has a great impact on this generation. I think he's a good example. And I think, you know, more so some of the people in the book, people like the guys I mentioned from Wilmington who are making this impact every day in unglamorous ways.
You're going to be speaking with Howard Dean tonight?
Yes, at the Strand at 7 p.m.
He's not a millennial.
He's not a millennial, but I've actually gotten to know him through the process of working on this book, and he's a big believer in this generation and our promise, and he's been very kind to do this with me this evening.
And that's tonight at 7 p.m. at the Strand Bookstore on Broadway and 12th Street. David D. Burstein's book is Fast Future, How the Millennial Generation is Shaping Our World. It's published by Beacon Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard. It's my pleasure.